But yes, we need... There was a lump in my throat. I realized I was trying not to cry. We need to decide.
We? This is your decision.
But I wanted to talk to you too. I know what I want to do, but this is your baby too, was what I'd been going to say. But I never got to finish. He let out a gasp like he'd been smacked and turned his face away. I stood up and moved towards the door.
Leo,
he said in a strangled voice.
Wait.
Look, my foot was already on the stairs, my bag over my shoulder. I know I sprang this on you. When you're ready to talk, call me, okay? But he never did. Claire rang me when I got home, and she was angry.
Where the hell were you? You stood me up. I waited half an hour in the Odeon foyer, and you weren't answering your calls.
I'm sorry, I said. I had stuff. I couldn't finish.
What? What's happened?
She asked, but I couldn't answer.
I'm coming over.
He never called. Instead, he texted later that night. I'd spent the afternoon with Claire agonizing over what to do, whether to tell my mum, whether James would be charged. We'd first done it when I was 15, although I was 16 now and had been for a couple of months. The text came through about 8 p.m.
Lee, I'm sorry, but this is your problem, not mine. Deal with it. And don't call me again. Jay.
And so I dealt with it. I never did tell my mum. Claire? Actually, Claire was kind of amazing. Yes, she could be snappy and snide and even manipulative, but in a crisis like this, she was like a lion defending her young. Looking back at that time, I remember why we were friends all those years, and it makes me realize again just how selfish I was afterwards. She took me to the clinic on the bus. It was early. Early enough to just take the pills, and it was all over surprisingly soon. It wasn't the abortion. I don't blame James for that. It was what I wanted myself. I didn't want a child at 16, and whatever happened, it was my fault as much as his. And whatever people might think, it wasn't that that fucked me up. I don't feel a crucifying guilt over the loss of a cluster of cells. I refuse to feel guilty. It wasn't any of that. It was... I don't know. I don't know how to put it. It was pride, I think. A kind of disbelief at my own stupidity. The thought that I'd loved him so much and had been so mistaken. How could I? How could I have been so incredibly, unbelievably wrong? And if I went back to that school, I would have to live with that knowledge. The memory of us both together in everyone's eyes. The telling of 100 people. No, we're not together. Yes, he dumped me. No, I'm fine. I wasn't fine. I was a fool. A fucking stupid little fool. How could I have been so mistaken? I'd always thought myself a good judge of character, and I had thought James was brave and loving and that he loved me. None of that was true. He was weak and cowardly, and he couldn't even look me in the eye to end it between us. I would never trust my own judgment again. We were on study leave when it happened, revising for our GCSEs. I went into school to take the exams, and then I never went back. Not to collect my results, not for the autumn social, not to see any of the teachers who'd coached and cheered me through my exams. Instead, I changed to a sixth form college 2 train rides away, one where I was sure no one could possibly know me. My day was insanely long. I left the house at 5:30 and got home at 6 every night. And then my mother moved house anyway to be with Phil. I should have been angry because she sold my grandfather's house where I grew up, where we'd all lived together for so many years, where all our memories were. And part of me was, but part of me was relieved. The last tie with Reading and with James was cut. I would never have to see him again. No one knew what had happened, apart from Claire. And even she didn't know about the text. I told her the next day that I'd decided I couldn't keep the baby and that I was breaking up with James. She hugged me and cried and said, "You're so brave." But I wasn't. I was a coward too. I never faced James. I never asked him why. How could he do that? Was it fear? Cowardice? I heard afterwards that he was sleeping his way systematically round Reading, girls and boys. It confirmed what I already knew. The James Cooper I thought I knew never existed. It was a figment of imagination, a false memory implanted by my own hopes. But now as I look back across 10 years, I don't know. It's not that I absolve James for the thoughtless cruelty of that text, but I see myself, furious, righteous, and so hard on both of us. Perhaps I absolve myself for the mistake I made in loving James. I realize how young we were, hardly more than children, with the careless cruelty of childhood and the rigid black-and-white morality, too. There is no grey when you're young. There's only goodies and baddies, right and wrong. The rules are very clear. A playground morality of ethical lines drawn out like a netball pitch, with clear fouls and penalties. James was wrong. I had trusted him. Therefore I was wrong too. But now I see a frightened child confronted with an immense moral decision he was not equipped to make. I see my words as he must have seen them, an attempt to shift this irrevocable choice onto his shoulders, a responsibility he was not prepared for and did not want. And I see myself, just as frightened, just as ill-prepared. And I feel so very sorry for us both. When Lamar comes in the morning, I will tell her. I'll tell her the whole truth. Unpicked like this, in the dying light of the evening, it's not as bad as I feared. It's not a motive for murder, just an old, tired grief. Nina was right. Then, at last, I sleep. But when Lamar comes in the morning, there's a new kind of grimness in her face. There's a colleague hovering behind her, a big hulk of a man, with a fleshy face set in a permanent frown. Lamar's holding something in her hand. "Nora," she says without preamble, "can you identify this for me?" "Yes," I say in surprise. "It's my phone. Where did you find it?" But Lamar doesn't answer. Instead, she sits, clicks on her tape recorder, and says in a grave, formal voice the words I've been dreading. "Leonora Shaw, we would like to question you as a suspect in the death of James Cooper. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defense if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence. You have a right to ask for a solicitor. Do you understand?" Chapter 27. If you're innocent, you have nothing to fear, right? Then why am I so frightened? My previous statements weren't taped, and I hadn't been cautioned. They wouldn't stand up as evidence in court, so the first few minutes are spent going over stuff I already told Lamar, re-establishing the facts for the purposes of the tape. I don't want a solicitor. I know it's stupid, but I can't get over the feeling that Lamar is on my side, that I trust her. If I can only convince her of my innocence, everything will be okay. What could a solicitor possibly do? Lamar finishes on the stuff we have already established and then starts on new ground. "Can you take a look at this phone, please?" She holds it out in a sealed plastic bag. "And let me know whether you recognize it." "Yes, it's my phone." I resist the urge to chew my nails. The last few days have ground them down to battered stubs.
"You're sure about that?"
"Yes, I recognize the scratch on the casing."
"And your phone number is..."
She flips through her pad and then reads it out. I nod. "Yes, that's correct.
I'm interested in the last few calls and texts you made. Can you run me through what you can remember? I wasn't expecting this. I can't see what relevance it can possibly have to James's death. Maybe they're trying to corroborate our movements or something. I know they can triangulate locations from mobile phone signals. I'm struggling to remember. Not many. There wasn't really any reception at the house. I checked my voicemail at the shooting range and Twitter. Oh, and I returned a call from a bike shop in London. They're servicing my bike. I think that's it.
No texts?
I don't think so. I'm trying to remember. No, I'm pretty sure not. I think the last one I sent was to Nina, telling her I was waiting on the train. That was Friday. She changes tack smoothly. I'd like to ask you a bit more about your relationship with James Cooper. I nod, trying to keep my expression even, helpful. But I've been expecting this. Maybe Claire has woken up. My stomach does a little uneasy shift.
You met back at school, is that right?
Yes. We were about 15, 16. We dated briefly, and then we broke up.
How briefly?
4 or 5 months. That's not quite true. We were together for 6 months, but I've already said briefly, and 6 months doesn't sound that brief. I don't want to look like I'm contradicting myself already. Luckily, Lamar doesn't quiz me about the dates.
Did you keep in contact after that?
She says. No.
She waits for me to elaborate.
I wait.
Lamar folds her hands in her lap and looks at me. I don't know what she's getting at, but if there's one thing I'm good at, it's keeping quiet.
The pause hangs heavy in the air. I can hear the tiny percussive tick of her expensive watch, and I wonder briefly where she gets her money from. That skirt wasn't bought on a police officer's salary. Neither were the chunky gold earrings. They look real. Still, it's none of my business, just something to speculate on as the time ticks past. But Lamar can wait, too. She has a kind of feline patience, that quality of unblinking composure as she waits for the mouse to panic and make a bolt for it. In the end, it's her companion who cracks, DC Roberts.
You're telling us you've had no contact with him for 10 years, he says brusquely. And yet he invited you to his wedding.
Fuck. But there's no point in lying about this. It would take them 2 minutes to check with Claire's mother or whoever handled the guest list. No. Claire invited me to the hen, but not to the wedding.
That's a bit odd, isn't it?
Lamar comes back in. She's smiling, as if this is girl talk over a cappuccino. Her cheeks are round and rosy, with high cheekbones that make her look like Nefertiti, and her mouth as she smiles is wide and warm and generous. Not really, I lie. I'm James's ex. I imagine Claire thought it would be awkward, for me as much as her.
So why invite you to the hen to celebrate her wedding? Wouldn't that be awkward too?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Claire.
So you've had no contact with James Cooper at all since you broke up?
No, no contact.
Texts, emails?
No, none. I'm suddenly not sure where this is going. Are they trying to establish that I hated James? That I couldn't bear to have him near me? My stomach does another uneasy shift, and a little voice in my head whispers, "It's not too late to ask for a lawyer." Look, I find myself saying, stress making my voice rise half a tone. It's hardly unusual not to keep in touch with your exes. But Lamar doesn't answer. She switches track again, bewilderingly.
Can you run me through your movements at the house? Were there any times you left the property?
Well, we went clay pigeon shooting, I say uncertainly, but you know about that.
I mean by yourself. You went for a run, isn't that right?
A run? I feel completely out of my depth all of a sudden. I hate not knowing what they're getting at. Yes, I say. I pick up a pillow and hug it to my chest. And then, feeling that I should look cooperative, twice, once when we arrived, on Friday, and once on Saturday.
Can you give me the approximate times?
I try to think back.
I think the Friday one was about 4:30, maybe, perhaps a bit later. I remember it was fairly dark. I met Claire on the drive on the way back, about 6 o'clock. And the Saturday one, it was early. Before 8, I think. I can't pin it down much better than that. Definitely not earlier than 6 a.m. It was light. Melanie was up, she might remember.
Okay.
Lamar is writing down the times, not trusting to the tape.
And you didn't use your phone on the runs?
No. What the hell is this about? My fingers dig into the soft kapok of the pillow.
What about Saturday night? Did you go out then?
No. Then I remember something. Did they tell you about the footprints?
Footprints?
She looks up from her pad, her face puzzled.
What footprints?
There were footprints in the snow. When I came back from my run that first morning, they were leading from the garage to the back door.
Hmm. I'll look into it. Thanks.
She makes a note. Then she changes tack again.
Have you remembered anything further about the period after you left the house on Saturday night, when you chased after the car?
I shake my head. I'm sorry. I remember tearing down through the wood. I get flashes of cars and broken glass and stuff. But no, nothing really concrete.
I see.
She shuts her notebook and stands up.
Thank you, Nora. Any further questions, Roberts?
Her companion shakes his head, and then Lamar gives the time and location for the tape, clicks off the recording, and leaves.
I am a suspect.
I sit there trying to process it after they've gone. Is it because they found my phone? But what could my phone possibly have to do with James's murder? And then I realize something. Something I should have known before. I was always a suspect. The only reason they weren't interviewing me under caution before was because any interview was worthless as evidence. With my memory problems, any lawyer could have shot a hole a mile wide in my statement. They wanted intelligence, the information I could provide, and they wanted it quick, enough to risk talking to me when I was in no state to be relied on. But now the doctors have confirmed I'm lucid, and I'm well enough to be interviewed properly. Now they are starting to build a case. I haven't been arrested. That's one thing to hold on to. I haven't been charged. Yet. If only I could remember those missing few minutes in the wood. What happened? What did I do? The desperation to remember rises inside me, sticking in my throat like a sob, and I clench my fingers on the soft pillow and bury my face in its clean whiteness, and I ache to remember. Without those missing few minutes, how can I hope to convince Lamar that what I'm saying is true? I close my eyes, and I try to think myself back there, to the quiet clearing in the forest, to the great glowing blocks of the house shining out through the dark, close-clustered trees. I smell again the scent of fallen pine needles. I feel the cold bite of the snow on my fingers and inside my nose. I remember the sounds of the forest, the soft patter of snow sliding from overladen branches, the hoot of an owl, the sound of an engine disappearing into the darkness. And I see myself tumbling down that long, straight track into the trees, feel the springy softness of the needles beneath my feet. But I cannot remember what comes next. When I try, it's like I'm trying to snatch at a scene reflected in a pond. Images come, but when I reach for them, they break into a thousand ripples, and I find that I'm holding only water. Something happened in that darkness. To me, Claire and James. Or someone. But who? What?
Well, Leonora, I'm very pleased with you.
Dr. Miller puts away his pen.
I'm a little bit concerned about the time you're still missing, but from what you're saying, those memories are starting to come back, and I don't see any reason to keep you here for much longer. You'll need further checkups, but they can all be arranged by your GP.
Before I can process what he's saying, he's carrying on.
Do you have anyone at home who can give you a hand? What?
No, I manage. I live alone.
Well, could you stay with a friend for a few days? Or have a friend come round to yours?
You've done amazingly well, but I'm slightly reluctant to let you go home to an empty house. I live in London, I say irrelevantly. What can I tell him? I don't have anyone I could foist myself on for a week, and I can't see myself trekking out to Australia to my mother's waiting arms.
I see. Is there anyone who can give you a lift back?
I try to think. Nina, maybe? I could ask her to help me get home, but surely they can't be throwing me out so soon. Suddenly I'm not sure I'm ready to leave. I don't understand, I say to the nurse after the doctor has picked up his notes and gone out. No one ever discussed this.
Don't worry, she says comfortingly. We won't throw you out with nowhere to go, but we do need the bed and you're no longer at risk, so
I am no longer wanted here. It's strange what a punch to the gut this news is. I realize that in the few short days I've been here, I've become institutionalized, in a way. For all this place feels like a cage, now the door is open, I don't want to leave. I've come to rely on the doctors and nurses and the routine of this hospital to protect me from the police, from the reality of what happened. What will I do if I'm thrown out? Will Lamar let me go home?
You should speak to the police, I find myself saying. I feel strangely detached. I don't know if they'll want me to leave Northumberland.
Oh, yes, I'd forgotten you were the poor lass who was in the accident. Don't worry, we'll make sure they know.
D.C. Lamar, I say. She's the one who's been coming here.
I don't want her to speak to Roberts with his thick neck and his frown.
I'll let her know. And don't worry, it won't be today anyway.
After she is gone, I try to process what just happened. I'm going to be thrown out, maybe as early as tomorrow. And then what? Either I will be allowed to go back to London, or I won't. And if I'm not, that means arrest. I try to remember what I know about my rights. If I'm arrested, I can be questioned for, what is it, 36 hours? I think they can get a warrant to extend it, but I can't completely remember. Fuck! I'm a crime writer. How can I not know this stuff?
I must phone Nina.
But I don't have my phone. I have a bed phone, but you need a bank card to buy credit, and my wallet and all my belongings are with the police. I could probably call from the nurse's station. I'm sure they'd lend me a phone if it was for something necessary, like getting a lift out of here. But I don't know her number. All my contacts are in my mobile. I try to recall any numbers I know off by heart. I used to know Nina's parents' number, but they've moved. I know my own home number, but that won't help. There's no one there. I used to know our home number off by heart, but that was the old house where I grew up. I don't know Mum's number in Australia. I wish I had someone like Jess. Someone I could turn to in any situation and say, without shame, I need you. But I don't. I always thought that being self-sufficient was a strength, but now I realize it's a kind of weakness, too. What the hell can I do? I guess I could ask the nurses to Google my editor, but the thought of facing her like this makes me go cold with shame. The one number I can recall perfectly is James's parents' number. I must have dialed it 100 times. He was always losing his mobile. And they still live there. I know they do. But I can't call them. Not like this. When I get back to London, I must phone them. I must ask about the funeral. I must... I shut my eyes. I will not cry. Not again. I can cry when I'm out of here, but for the moment, I have to be practical. I cannot think about James or his mother and father. And then my gaze alights on the paper cup beside my bed. Matt's number. I rip the cup carefully and fold the scribbled mobile into my pocket. I can't phone him. He'll be on his way back to London. But it's an odd comfort to think that I have at least one person I could call in a dire emergency. 2 days ago, I had no idea he existed. And now, he's my one link to the outside world. It will be okay, though. Nina will come back, or Lamar will. I'll be able to get a message out to them. I just have to wait.
I am still sitting, staring into space and biting my battered nails, when a nurse puts her head around the door.
Call for you, Dougie. I'll put them through on the bed phone.
She gestures to the white plastic phone suspended on an arm beside my bed and then slips out.
Who can it be? Who knows I'm here? Could it be my mum?
I look at the clock. No, it would be the middle of the night in Australia. Then, like a cold hand on the back of the neck, a thought comes to me.
James's parents. They must know I'm here.
The phone starts to ring. For a moment, I lose all courage and I almost don't answer it. But then I grip my teeth and force myself to pick up the receiver.
Hello?
There's a pause, and then a voice says, Nora, is that you? It's Nina. Relief floods through me, and for an irrational second I wonder about telepathy.
Nina!
It's so good to hear her voice, to know I'm not stranded here.
Thank God you called. They might be chucking me out, and I realized I don't have your number or anything. Is that why you're calling?
No,
she says shortly.
Listen, I'm not going to beat around the bush. Flo's tried to commit suicide.
Chapter 28.
I can't speak.
Nora, Nina says after a moment. Nora, are you still there?
Shit, has this thing cut me off?
Yes, I say, dazedly. Yes, I'm here. I'm just... Jesus.
I didn't want to tell you like this, but I didn't want you to hear it from one of the nurses or the police or something. She's being taken to your hospital.
Oh, my God. Is she going to be okay?
I think so, yes. I found her in the bathroom at the B&B where we're staying. She's been pretty off the wall, but I didn't realise I...
She sounds shaken, and I realise for the first time the strain that she has probably been under. While Claire and I are in hospital, avoiding the brunt of the interrogations, Nina, Flo and Tom have presumably been questioned round the clock.
It was pure luck I came back earlier than I said I would. I should have noticed. It's been horrible, but I never thought.
It's not your fault.
I'm a bloody doctor, Nora.
Her voice at the other end of the phone is anguished.
Okay, it's a while since I've done anything in mental health, but we're supposed to remember our basic training.
Shit! I should have seen this coming.
But she'll be okay.
I don't know. She took a bunch of sleeping pills combined with some Valium and a hell of a lot of paracetamol, washed down with whiskey. It's the paracetamol that's worrying me. It's pretty nasty stuff. You can wake up feeling just fine in hospital, and then your liver packs up just when you've decided suicide really isn't going to fit in with your spring calendar.
Oh, my God. Poor Flo. Did she give a reason?
She just left the note saying she couldn't cope any longer.
Do you think...
I stop. I can't think how to ask this.
What? Has she got a guilty conscience?
I almost hear Nina's shrug down the phone.
I don't know, but whatever you reckon happened, she was holding the gun. I don't think Lamar and Roberts went particularly easy on her.
How did she get the pills?
She got prescribed the diazepam and the sleeping pills. We've all been under a lot of stress, Nora. She saw a man get shot. That's PTSD kind of stuff.
I shut my eyes. I've been safe here, wrapped in my cocoon of ignorance, while Flo has been falling apart.
She was so obsessed, I say slowly.
Do you remember the way she kept on going on about giving Claire the perfect 10?
I know,
Nina says.
Believe me, we heard a lot about that the last couple of days. She's not done much except for cry and blame herself for what happened.
But what did happen, Nina?
I realise suddenly that I'm gripping the white plastic receiver so hard that my fingers hurt.
Lamar thinks it's murder. I know she does. They're asking weird questions about my phone. They've given me a formal caution. I'm a suspect.
We're all suspects, Nina says wearily.
We were in a house when a man got shot and died. It's not just you.
Fuck, I wish this were over. I'm missing Jess so much I can barely think. Why the fuck did we agree to this, Nora?
She sounds tired. Tired not just of this, but of everything.
I can see her suddenly, her and Tom, alone in their B&B rooms, waiting to be questioned, waiting for answers, waiting for news on Flo and Claire and everything else. They've asked her not to leave. She's just as trapped as me, trapped by what happened in that house.
Look, I've got to go, Nina says at last. This is a crappy pay-as-you-go mobile, and I don't think there's much credit on it. But I'll phone back and leave the number at the desk, yeah? Tell them to call me if you get kicked out.
Okay, I say at last. There's a catch in my throat, and I cough, trying to hide it. Take care of yourself, you hear me? And don't beat yourself up over Flo. She'll be okay.
I really don't know if she will,
Nina says. Her voice is bleak.
I saw a few paracetamol overdoses when I was a med student, and I know how it goes. But thanks for trying. And, Nora...
She stops. Yes? I say.
Oh, fuck. Look, it's pointless me saying this. Forget it.
What?
I was just going to say... Try to remember what happened after you left the house, yeah? There's a lot riding on this.
No pressure, she says with a slightly shaky laugh.
Yeah, I know, I say. Bye, Nina.
Bye.
She hangs up and I rub my face.
No pressure, Nina said. I assume it was her idea of a joke. She knows as well as I do the pressure that we're under. All of us.
I must remember. I must remember. I shut my eyes and try to remember.
Nora.
A hand on my shoulder, shaking me awake.
Nora.
I blink and try to sit up, try to process where I am and what's going on. It's Lamar. I've been asleep.
What time is it?
I say blearily.
It's nearly noon, she says.
Her voice is crisp. There's no hint of a smile now. In fact, she looks very grave. DC Roberts is behind her, his glower fixed and unmoving. He looks like he was born with a pencil and a sour expression. It's impossible to imagine him cuddling a baby or kissing a lover.
We'd like to ask you some more questions,
Lamar says.
Do you want a minute?
No, I'm okay, I say. I shake my head, trying to wake myself. Lamar watches.
Go ahead,
I say. Lamar nods, clicks on the tape recorder, and repeats the caution. Then she gets out a piece of paper.
Nora, I'd like you to read this. It's a transcript of emails and text messages taken from your and James's phones over the last few days.
She hands the paper to me, and I sit up straighter and rub the sleep from my eyes, trying to focus on the closely typed sheets of paper. They're a list of texts, each annotated with the number they were sent from and a date, time, and some other information I can't interpret. GPS location, maybe. The first one is marked with my number and Friday, 4:52 p.m. Leonora Shaw.
James, it's me, Leo. Leo Shaw.
James Cooper.
Leo? Christ, is that really you?
Leonora Shaw.
Yes, it's me. I really need to see you. I'm at Claire's hen weekend. Please can you come up? It's urgent.
James Cooper.
What? Seriously?
James Cooper.
Has C told you?
Leonora Shaw.
Yes. Please come up. I can't say what this is about over the phone, but I really need to speak to you.
James Cooper.
You really need me to come? Can't it wait until you're back in London?
Leonora Shaw.
No,
It's really urgent. Please. I've not asked you for anything, but you owe me this. Tomorrow? Sunday's too late. The next reply from James is not until 11:44 p.m. James Cooper.
I've got a matinee and an evening tomorrow. I won't be finished at the theatre till 10/11. I could drive up, but it will take me 5+ hours. I'll be there in the middle of the night. You really want me to do this?
Saturday, 7:21 a.m. Leonora Shaw.
Yes.
Saturday, 2:32 p.m. James Cooper.
Okay.
Leonora Shaw.
Thank you.
Leave your car in the lane. When you get to the house, go round the back. I'll leave the kitchen door unlocked. My room is at the top of the stairs, second door on the right. I'll explain everything when you get here.
There is another long pause. James's reply is marked 5:54 p.m., and it almost breaks my heart.
James Cooper.
Okay. I'm so sorry, Leo. For everything.
J.
Kiss.
And then, at 11:18 p.m., James Cooper.
I'm on my way.
And then that's it. When I look up at Lamar, I know that my eyes are swimming and my voice is cracked and mute.
The interviewee has finished reading the transcript, she says quietly for the benefit of the tape, and then...
Well, Nora?
Any explanation? Did you think we wouldn't find these? Deleting them was pretty pointless, you know. We recovered them off the server.
I try. I take a deep breath, force myself to speak. I didn't send these.
Really?
It's not a question, just a flat, slightly tired acknowledgement.
Really? You have to believe me.
I know, even as I begin to gabble, that it's hopeless.
Someone else could have sent them. Someone could have cloned my SIM card.
Believe me, we're used to that, Nora. These were sent from your phone, and the date stamps on your replies correspond to your runs in the forest and the trip to the Clay Pigeon Range.
But I didn't take my phone on my runs.
The GPS evidence is pretty conclusive. We know that you went out of the house and up the hill until you got a signal.
I didn't send them,
I repeat hopelessly. I want to crawl back into bed and pull the covers over my head. Lamar is looking down at me from her full height. No cozy sitting on the bed now. Her face is set, like carved ebony. There's compassion in her face, but also a kind of rigour that I never noticed until now. Her face has the sort of unsparing detachment I imagine an angel might show. Not an angel of mercy, but an angel of judgment.
We've also got the report back on the analysis of the car, Nora. We know what happened.
What happened?
I am trying not to panic, but I know my voice has got shaky and shrill. They know. They know something that I don't.
What happened?
Claire picked you up, and when she was safely on the road and travelling at speed, you grabbed the wheel. Do you remember? You grabbed the wheel and forced the car off the road.
No!
Your fingerprints are all over the wheel. The scratches on your hands, the broken nails. You were fighting Claire. She has defensive wounds on her hands and arms. Your skin was under her nails.
No!
But even as I say it, I get a flash, like a nightmare breaking into day. Claire's terrified face, green lit by the dashboard glow, my hands grappling with hers.
No,
I say, but there is a sob in my voice. What have I done?
What did Claire tell you, Nora? Did she tell you that she was marrying James?
I can't speak. I just shake my head, but it's not a denial. I cannot deal with this. I cannot take these questions.
The interviewee is shaking her head,
Roberts puts in gruffly.
Flo told us what happened, Lamar says relentlessly. Claire asked her to keep it under wraps. She was planning to tell you this weekend, wasn't she?
Oh, God.
You've never had another relationship since you broke up with him, isn't that right?
No. No. No.
You were obsessed with him. Claire put off telling you because she was worried about your reaction. She was right to be worried, wasn't she?
Please let me wake from this nightmare.
And so you lured him up to the house, and then you shot him.
No. Oh, Jesus, I must speak. I must say something to make Lamar shut up, to make these smooth, plum-coloured, vicious accusations go away.
It's true, isn't it, Nora?
She says, and her voice is soft and gentle. And finally, at last, she sits on the end of my bed and puts out her hand.
Isn't it?
I look up. My eyes are swimming. But through it, I see Lamar's face, her sympathetic eyes, her heavy earrings, impossibly heavy for such a slender neck to support. I hear the click and whir of the tape recorder. I find my voice. I want to see a solicitor. Chapter 29. I try to think back to the timestamp on the first text, the one I supposedly sent to James, the one sent from my phone at 4:52 p.m. I was out on my run. My phone was unprotected up in my room. So who else had access to it? Claire hadn't arrived yet, I know that for sure, since I met her in the drive coming up to the house, but it could have been any of the others. But why? Why would they want to destroy me like this? Destroy James? Destroy Claire? I try to think through the possibilities. Melanie seems the least likely. Yes, she was there while I was out on my run. In fact, she was one of the few people who was up and about at the time of the second run. But I can't believe that she could possibly care about me or James enough to do this. Why risk everything to incriminate someone she'd never even met? And besides, she'd gone by the time James arrived, by the time... I shut my eyes, trying to shut out the pictures of James lying shattered and bloody on the wooden floor. She could still have swapped the cartridge, a tiny voice whispers in the back of my mind. She could have done that at any time. And maybe that would explain why she left in such a hurry. It's true, she could have swapped the cartridge. But surely she couldn't have predicted the rest, the open door, the gun, the struggle. Tom, then. He had the means. He was there in the house when my phone was. He was there at the shooting. And, it suddenly strikes me, he was the one who sent Claire driving off into the forest alone. What did make her suddenly leave like that? We only have his word about what he said to her, and now, in the light of what's happened, the fact that she misheard him so radically seems a little convenient. Would she really just go haring off into the night like that, without double-checking? Nina was the doctor, after all. She was James's best chance of survival. What if he told her to go? He could have said anything. That Nina wasn't coming, that she'd said to get going and wait for her at the hospital. As for motive, I think back to the drunken conversation we had about his husband and James. If only I'd paid attention, if only I'd listened. But I was bored, bored by the litany of names I didn't recognize and the bitchy theatre politics. Is it possible that there's something there, some grudge between Bruce and James? Or maybe... maybe quite the opposite. It seems unlikely, though, and even if he did send Claire off into the night, what would it achieve? He couldn't have predicted what would happen. Most importantly, though, he could not have known about my past with James. Unless someone told him. Claire could have told him. I can't get away from that. But the thing is this. This murder has been set up in such a way that it didn't just destroy James. It is destroying me and Claire, too. It doesn't just feel like collateral damage. There is something incredibly malicious and personal about the way I have been deliberately dragged in, reminding us both of long-forgotten sores. Who would do that? Why would anyone do that? I try to look at this like one of my books. If I were writing this, I could imagine a reason for Tom to hurt James, and I could probably manufacture a motive for him to hurt Claire in the process. But me? Why go to all these lengths to bring in someone he doesn't even know? The only person who could possibly want to do that would be someone who knows all three of us. Someone who was there at the time it all blew up. Someone like Nina. But my mind shies away from that, flinching from the idea. Nina can be odd, sharp and sarcastic, and often thoughtless. But there's no way she'd do something like that. Surely. I think of her face, set in stern lines like grief as she remembered the gunshot wounds she'd treated in Colombia. She lives to help people. Surely she'd never do this. But something is whispering in my ear, a little voice reminding me of how callous Nina can be. I remember her saying once, very drunk, "Surgeons don't care about people. Not in a touchy-feely way. They're like mechanics. They just want to cut them up, see how they work, dismantle them. Your average surgeon's like a little boy who takes apart his dad's watch to see how it works and then can't get it back together. The more skilled you get, the better you get at reassembling the parts. But we always leave a scar." And I think, too, about her occasional shocking flashes of contempt for Claire. I think about her savagery that night, when she talked about how Claire wanted to push and prod and get off on other people's reactions. Her bitterness about the way Claire outed her all those years ago. Is there something there? Some reason she's never forgiven Claire? And finally, I think about her actions on the first night we arrived, the I Have Never game. I remember the deliberate malice of her drawling, "I have never fucked James Cooper." Suddenly, in the overheated little sauna of a room, I feel cold. Because that is the kind of cruel, personal spite that lies behind this whole crazy situation. It wasn't just curiosity about me and James. It wasn't thoughtlessness. It was deliberate cruelty to me and to Claire. Who is pushing and prodding and getting off on people's reactions now? But I push that thought away. I will not think about Nina like this. I will not. This will send me mad if I let it. Flo. Flo is the name I keep coming back to. Flo was there from the beginning. Flo invited the guests. Flo held the gun. Flo was the one who claimed it was loaded with blanks. Flo, with her strange obsession with Claire, with her unstable intensity. She could have found out about me and James at any point. She's Claire's best friend, after all, has been since university. What more likely than Claire confiding in her about James and me? Is that why she's taken an overdose? Has she realized what she's done? I am looking up, looking into space as I think all this out. And then suddenly my eyes focus on something, on a movement outside the door. And I realize what it is. The guard is back. The police guard at my door. Only this time I have absolutely zero doubt. They are not there to protect me. They are there to keep me in. I'm not going home when they discharge me. I'm going to a police station. I will be arrested and questioned and most likely charged if they think they can make this stick. Coldly, dispassionately, I try to examine the last person at the hen night. The case against myself. I was there. I could have sent those texts to James. I could have swapped the live round for the blanks. I had my hand on the gun when Flo fired. What could be more easy than nudging the barrel to ensure it was pointing at James as he came up the stairs? And, more importantly, I was there at the second half of James's murder. I was in the car when it drove off the road. What the hell happened in that car? Why can't I remember? I think back to what Dr. Miller said. Sometimes the brain suppresses events that we're not quite ready to deal with. I suppose it's a coping mechanism, if you will. What is it that my brain cannot cope with? Is it the truth? I realize I'm shivering as if I'm cold, even though the heat of the hospital is as stifling as ever, and I pull Nina's cardigan from the foot of the bed and huddle it round myself, breathing in her scent of fags and perfume, trying to steady myself. It's not the thought of being arrested and charged that has shocked me so much. I still don't believe that will really happen. Surely, surely, if I just explain everything, they will believe me. What has really knocked me off balance is this. Someone hates me enough to do this. But who? I don't let myself think about the final possibility. It's one too horrible for me to allow into my mind, except in tiny, niggling whispers when I'm thinking about other things. But as I huddle down beneath the thin hospital blanket, Nina's cardigan around my shoulders, one of those whispers comes. What if it's true? The rest of the day goes slowly, as if I'm moving through air made of treacle. It feels like the nightmares I sometimes have where my limbs are too heavy to move. Something is pursuing me, and I have to get away, but I'm stuck in mud. My legs are numb and slow, and all I can do is wade painfully through the dream, with the unspecified horror behind me getting closer and closer. My little room feels more and more like a prison cell, with the narrow hatch of reinforced glass and the guard outside the door. If they release me, I know now what will happen. I will not be going home. I will be arrested and taken to a police station, and then probably charged. The texts are enough evidence to hold me, along with the fact that I denied having sent them. I remember a long time ago when I wrote my first book, speaking to a policeman about interviewing techniques.
"You listen," he said. "You listen for the lie."
Lamar and Roberts have found their lie. I told them I did not send those texts, and yet there they are. I try to eat, but the food is tasteless, and I leave most of it on the tray. I try to do a crossword, but the words fall away from me. They are just typing on a page, and my mind's eye is being invaded by other pictures. Me, in the dock at court, in a prison cell. Flo, on life support, somewhere in this very hospital. Claire, flat on a bed, her eyes moving slowly beneath her closed lids. James, in a pool of spreading blood. Suddenly my nostrils are filled with the smell of it, the butcher's shop smell of his blood on my hands and my pyjamas and leaching into the floor. I throw off the covers and stand up. I walk to the bathroom to splash my face with water, trying to wash away the stench of blood and the invading memories. But the memories I want don't come. Is it possible? Is it possible I did send those texts and I have just buried it along with whatever happened in the car? Who can I trust if I can't even trust myself? I put my face in my hands, and when I stand, I look at myself in the mirror beneath the unforgiving fluorescent light. The bruises around my eyes are still there, but fading. I look jaundiced, hollow-eyed. There are dark patches in the hollows at the bridge of my nose and beneath my lower lids, but I no longer look like a freak. If I had concealer, I could cover the shadows up, but I don't. I never thought to ask Nina for that. I look thin and old. My face is crumpled where I have been lying on the hard hospital sheets. I think of the me I am inside. In my head, I have been 16 for nearly 10 years. My hair is still long. I find myself going to sweep it back in moments of stress, and it's not there. In my head, James is still alive. I cannot believe that he isn't. Would they let me see his body? I shiver, rake my wet hand through my crumpled hair, and rub my palms on the grey jogging bottoms. Then I turn and leave the bathroom. As I come out of the ensuite, it strikes me that something is different. I can't work out what it is. My book is still there on the bed,
My flip-flops are beneath. My water jug is half full on the locker, and the file of notes is still stuck crookedly into the holder at the foot of the bed. Then I see. The guard is not there. I walk to the door, peering out through the wire-hatched pane. The chair is there. A cup of tea is there, steaming gently. But no guard. A little prickle of adrenaline runs through me, making the hairs on my neck shiver. My body knows what I am about to do even before my mind has processed it. My fingers are reaching for the flip-flops, easing them on. My hands are buttoning Nina's cardigan. Lastly, I reach for the two £10 note still lying folded on the corner of the locker. My heart is thumping as I press gently on the panel of the door, expecting at any moment to hear a shout of stop, or just a nurse saying, "Are you all right, dear?" But no one says anything. No one does anything. I walk out of the room and down the corridor, past the other bays, with my feet in my flip-flops going plip, plip, plip against the linoleum floor. Past the nursing station. There is no one there. The nurse is inside the little office, but her back is to the glass, doing paperwork. Plip, plip, plip. Through the double doors and out into the main corridor, where the air smells less of Lysol and more of industrial cooking from the kitchens down the corridor. I walk a little faster. There is a sign saying "Way Out," pointing round a corner. As I turn it, my heart almost stops. There is the police officer, standing just outside the men's toilets, muttering into his radio. For a moment I falter. I nearly turn tail and run back to my room before he can discover I'm gone. But I don't. I recover myself, and I walk on past. Plip, plip, plip. With my heart going bang, 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 in time with my steps. And he doesn't give me a second glance.
"Roger,"
he says as I pass him.
"Copy that."
And then I round the corner, and he's gone. I keep walking, not too fast, not too slow. Surely someone will stop me. Surely you can't just walk out of a hospital like this. There's a sign saying "Exit," pointing along the corridor between cubicles of beds. I'm almost there. And then, as I'm almost at the last door before the lift lobby, I see something, someone, through the narrow pane of glass. It's Lamar. My breath catches in my throat, and almost without thinking, I duck backwards into a curtained cubicle, praying that the occupant is asleep. I edge the curtain stealthily around myself, my heart banging in my throat, and stand, waiting, listening. There's the noise of the main ward doors opening and closing, and then I hear her heels going click-clack, click-clack across the linoleum floor. At the nurse's station, almost opposite the cubicle where I'm hiding, the steps pause, and I stand, hands trembling, waiting for the curtain to be ripped back, waiting for the discovery. But then she says something polite to the matron on duty, and I hear the heels go click-clack, click-clack down the corridor towards the toilets and my room. Oh, thank God. Thank God. Thank God. My legs are weak and shaking with relief, and for a minute I don't think I can stand. But I have to. I have to get out of here before she gets to my room and realizes I'm gone. I suddenly wish I'd thought to put pillows in the bed or draw the little curtain across the window. I take two or three deep breaths, trying to calm myself, and then I turn, ready to apologize to the occupant of the cubicle behind me. But when I see who is in the bed, my heart almost stops. It's Claire. Claire, lying with her eyes closed, her golden hair spread out across the pillow. She is very pale, and her face is even more badly cut up than mine. There's a monitor clipped onto her finger and more wires leading under the blankets. Oh, my God. Oh, Claire. I know it's crazy, but I can't stop myself. My hand strays towards her face, and I brush a strand of hair away from her lips. Her eyes flicker beneath her lids, and I hold my breath. But then she relaxes back into whatever state she's in. Sleep. Coma. And I let out a gasping sigh. "Claire," I whisper, very soft, so that no one will hear, but perhaps it will filter through into her dreams. "Claire,
It's me, Nora.